Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Human Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
This is the last class of our 2020 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study for Saturday. We're going to conclude with the fire discourse, and it's a short sutta, and I'm just going to repeat this on Tuesday to conclude this study. But then next weekend, interesting timing, we're going to have our online retreat beginning Friday evening at, I can't remember the schedule, I think it's 7 or 7:30. And so all of those that were that had a reservation for our spring retreat are first in line for this retreat. But I'm just asking you, even if you have reserved the space to, and you haven't already done this, just send me an email saying that you will be attending the online retreat, just so I can get an idea. And I'm going to try to keep the number down to 24 or less. Right now there's 15 of us, so that's fine. But just so I know who I can let in and who I can't, and let them know.
Well, I'm curious, John, what does the online retreat consist of?
I don't mean to be dismissive. The information is on the website and the whole schedule and all the suttas, but it's the theme is true refuge, and so every sutta kind of relates to that. I'm going to start with two suttas on the Buddha's meaning on refuge, and then we're going to have teachings from our four other teachers too during that retreat. So the schedule's there. Everything that's included in the retreat is there, and like I said, just send me an email if you're going to attend. There was something else I was going to say. Oh, just about the retreat. And you could take this as all of our online meetings. If something occurs, and I was thinking about this in relation to our retreat, just because we're doing something over 3 days. If something occurs and I have to shut down a meeting completely, within a few minutes, I'll start a new meeting. So if that happens now during our weekly classes and we lose the connection for some reason, just come back on in a couple minutes and there'll be a new meeting established, if I can. And I'll do the same thing during our retreat. If somebody hacks us and I need to shut down a session, I will. And I'll just start a new session in a few minutes, just so everybody knows that. Again, the schedule's on the website. And if you're joining us on our retreat, just please come to sessions a little bit early. I think it's going to be a wonderful experience to do it that way. Anybody have any questions about that, about the retreat?
Yeah, John, it's Lorna. I've got one.
Yes.
If you're not doing the retreat, can we assume that there isn't a class next Saturday?
There is not there's no class on Saturday. So, when is our session? I think our session on Saturday morning is 9:30. If there's enough room, you can join us online, though. You know, at 9:30 with the schedule. So. All right, so this is this last chapter in the book is there for a reason. It gets to the heart of the matter. Those of us that now understand the Dhamma, whether you just began 12 weeks ago or whatever it was, a while ago with the Truth of Happiness book, you now have enough knowledge about what the Buddha actually taught to properly apply this very, I think it's one of the most inspired teachings that I've ever read. And when you understand the context, this is the third sutta the Buddha ever taught. It's called one of the cardinal discourses, which simply means it's one of the three most significant suttas the Buddha ever taught. And if you look at these first three suttas, they address each one of them in their own individual but subtle ways, the three marks of existence. And so this is addressing the origination of stress and suffering in our lives, rooted in passions that themselves are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So this is from a bit of the introduction, then I'm going to get right to the sutta. About a month after the Buddha's first two discourses, he presented the fire discourse, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, the fire discourse, to approximately 1,000 followers. Which itself is remarkable when you think about it. This is just a couple of months into his teaching career, and he already has gathered all these followers, approximately 1,000 followers. Upon hearing this short discourse, most of those in attendance awakened. At that time in northern India and southern Nepal, there were various cults engaged in ritualistic worship. One of these cults was a popular fire cult devoted to rituals using fire. The Buddha used the fire worshippers, as he often did, as analogy to how individual personalities worship what contacts the senses. And that really is true. And worship you could say a very broad, but also a very specific way, that we get an idea in our head, whatever it might be. And in my case, it might be playing center field for the Yankees. And I let that go about a week ago. It becomes your worship. It becomes your reason for being here. And we can do that not with just one thing. It's not just center field for the Yankees. It's what's going to happen to me tomorrow. And I hope that little girl really likes me. And she's not, you know, all these things, that these scenarios we play out in our heads then become worship in the sense that it's a primary distraction from actually living our lives. And listen to the Buddha's words, how he describes how we do that. And I'm not quite there yet. This is still part of the introduction. The fire discourse presented below is a brief but insightful look at how the physical senses, interpreted by the intellect, reinforce the belief in self. And so you remember from dependent origination, when we get to contact rooted in feelings, it's that contact that the Buddha describes as starting to reinforce the ignorance that is part of the foundation of dependent origination. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. And fabrications are now altering the decisions we're making about what's coming in contact with our senses. We're filtering those and adapting and molding our view of what's occurring to fit our view rather than what's actually occurring. And this, again, this sutta, like, and you hear me say this often, this is a complete Dhamma teaching when you understand the context. The Buddha was staying in Gaya Head with 1,000 monks. There he addressed those. And you know, in my restoration, as Matt likes to use, that's really the right word. I was struggling for how should I label what I do with the suttas. And translation isn't quite right because I'm not translating it, but I'm hoping to restore it back to what the Buddha taught. And so that's what this is referring to. And so when I use the word monks as opposed to just friends or a generic title, it's because the sutta itself doesn't allow it. You'll those of you that have listened to me and read my stuff, when it's appropriate, I always change that. I always make the reference as gender neutral as I can if it's maintaining an authenticity to the sutta. So this sutta, it was early in the Buddhist teaching. There were no nuns yet in part of the Sangha. Monks, the Buddha's words, monks, the all is a flame. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame, meaning what my thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. In that condition, when something comes in contact with my eye, and the Buddha classifies our senses as having their own type of consciousness, and when you think about it, it's brilliant to look at it that way. So something comes in contact with my eye, that consciousness, that ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, not some cosmic consciousness, human consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is now interpreting what is coming in contact with the eye through that eye consciousness. And so consciousness at the eye is a flame, is what the Buddha is saying. Anything that comes into contact with my eyes and with all of my physical senses can only hope to inflame or set my passions aflame with wanting more, with desire, with craving, with aversion. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact at the eye is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence at contact at the eye, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. So what does the Buddha mean, whatever arises in dependence on that contact? It's not that when I look at a tree, that tree becomes manifest in the physical world simply because I looked at it. But some people actually misinterpret that by saying that, and there's a sect of Theravadan beliefs that greatly embellish dependent origination and claim that it is a creation myth where the Buddha's teaching us actually how to create physical reality. He never bothered with any of that, and that's not what the Buddha's referring to. Whatever arises in dependence on contact at the eye refers to anything that's arising in this moment that I want more of, less of, or I'm simply bored with it. I'm ambiguous to it. That's what's arising in dependence on my eye consciousness at the present moment. Is that clear with everyone? Because that's an important point. Yes? Is anybody confused about that? What is arising is ignorance in this moment. Ram, you had a question?
Yeah, is he referring to dependent origination there already?
Yes. It's a great question. I just stumbled a little bit on the answer because he's not referring directly to the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta, but he is, and I think that was your question, he is referring to the process of dependent origination, of a mind rooted in ignorance creating the stress and suffering. And that stress and suffering occurs through contact through it with our senses, doesn't it? And it's such an utterly practical teaching that it's difficult to see because it's just what we do. It's how we live our human life. There's no difference between what an uninformed, unawakened human being does with their senses as an awakened human being does with their senses, except that awakened human being knows how to interpret reality. Four Noble Truths. We see things in the framework of Four Noble Truths as developed through the Eightfold Path. Is that clear? Yes? Okay. Thanks, Ron.
I had a question, but a reinterpretation. That's not the word. But I just wanted to kind of deeply see your point, because I too, as I read the sutta, flame, that my eyes flame, ears are flame, nose and all this. Is this pointing to our eye is, like the way I interpret it, and I just correct you if I'm wrong, the eye, ear, and all this is enslaved to what it's seeing, hearing, touching, tasting. Because for me, when I see dependent co-origination and being trapped in that cycle, it's like it's a slavery in that cycle.
Yep.
And so be able to break that becomes the practice. So for me, a flame slavery is synonymous. But I wanted to see, is that, what do you think about that type of connection?
Well, yeah, thank you, Dathane. I think it's just using a different term. Meaning you're using enslaved as opposed to worship. But the subtle clinging connection is the same, isn't it, as slavery.
Yeah.
And so we become slaves to the things that we worship. So it's really... I'm not going to say it's just semantics because, and I would hesitate in my teaching to use the word enslaved because of the connotations that it has, but on an individual level of understanding, I think it really describes it in not too extreme a way, but using that in it just as part of normal rhetoric, I think it might be too strong a term. But that's exactly what we do with our senses. We enslave ourselves to whatever we're desiring, whether it's desiring more of something or less of something. So it's a great way of putting it. We become enslaved to what we want, what our desires. So. Okay. The Buddha continues. A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion, the fire of aversion, and the fire of delusion. The Buddha is saying a flame with the... with greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking. Buddha continues, a flame, I tell you, with birth, with aging and death, a flame with sorrows, regret, pain, distress, and despairs. A flame with it. So what is the Buddha saying? Is we are reacting to normal human life. We're reacting to the birth process. We're reacting to what we're giving birth to in this moment, which is the most important translation/interpretation of the Buddha's meaning of birth, and we are aflame with worried about aging, aflame with every one of these things, aflame with death, aflame with sorrow, meaning I don't want to feel the occasional sorrow that comes with having a human life. an awakened human being understands sorrow as sorrow. There's many suttas that we've read where the Buddha says, sorrow is sorrow, treat sorrow as sorrow. Regret is regret. It's just what it is. It's what's occurring in this moment. It's not something that that should inflame our passions, yet because of a mind prone to worshiping what it holds in mind, becoming enslaved to its own thoughts, then we are inflamed, and we're doing it ourselves. This isn't something that just because we have a thought that it inflames our passions. It's just because we have a thought when those thoughts are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Meaning there's a simple and direct way out of this. Excuse me for a moment. The Buddha continues. The ear is aflame, sounds are aflame. The nose is aflame, aromas are aflame. The tongue is aflame, flavors are aflame. The body is aflame, tactile sensations are aflame. The intellect is aflame, and so ideas are aflame. Consciousness at the intellect is aflame. What the Buddha is saying with this rather strong rhetoric is you can't trust your senses when your minds are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And if those of us that have enough concentration to actually dispassionately look at their behavior, we'll recognize this, that we're driven to do things that we might not normally do or be distracted by because we have given in to that self-referential passion for continued self-establishment moment by moment. The self-referential ego personality whole purpose for this moment is to continue to establish itself. And the Buddha's Dhamma contradicts in this moment and only in this moment that deluded way of thinking. It's what this sutta is pointing to, right? Also, the immediacy of Dhamma practice. It must be done right here and right now. And saying something like this is clear direction on how do we apply this, ehipasiko. Contact at the intellect is aflame. So what do we want to do as Dhamma practitioners learning from this sutta? We want to be mindfully aware that in this moment, as I am contacting phenomena, is where I practice the Dhamma. It's not sometime in the future, and I can't do anything. Applying the Dhamma to something that has occurred has absolutely no benefit, and it's just a distraction, right here, right now. And whatever, the Buddha continues, and whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion, greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking. A flame, I say, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, regret, pains, and distress, and despairs. Seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones grows disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with consciousness at the eye, disenchanted with contact at the eye. And whatever there is that arises in dependence at contact at the eye, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that they grow disenchanted too. So again, what the Buddha is teaching us is to start training ourselves through understanding. And remember the setting for the metaphor here, the fire worshippers. He's taking that analogy and directing it towards us as wise Dhamma disciples and say, look at what you're doing with your desires. You worship them. You become inflamed by them, and it rules your life. But he also teaches us how to recognize the process we're doing and where to apply these most brilliant of teachings at the point of contact. So you've heard me say this over and over again, haven't you? Yes. That the Dhamma is practiced at the point of contact with life as life occurs. And this is the sutta that truly inspires that teaching. Contact at the eye, ear, nose, body, and the consciousness is where we practice the Dhamma. It's where we can come in contact with our own inflamed way of thinking, our own, using the Thane's term, our own enslaved way of thinking, meaning enslaved to our fabrications. This is where we practice the Dhamma, and it's where we can put the fires of our passions out, as the Buddha continues to teach us. He grows disenchanted with the ear. Let me use the generic. They go disenchanted with the ear, disenchanted with the nose, disenchanted with the tongue, and disenchanted with the body. They grow disenchanted with the intellect. What a powerful statement. The last application of Dhamma is at our thought processes. I think you would all understand this, have experienced it. As we start practicing the Dhamma, our recognition of fabrications is on a very gross level. It's simply the way it is. It's what's obvious. But as we continue to deepen our understanding of the Dhamma and start practicing at very, very, very subtle levels, this is where we arrive at. There was something I wanted to... It's coming. He grows disenchanted with the intellect, disenchanted with ideas. What are these ideas? They're ideas that otherwise are rooted in ignorance. They're ideas that are a mind rooted in ignorance and fabricating its view of reality, compulsively churns out to maintain that ignorance. And so the Buddha is saying, look at that process you're doing. That's what this teaching is. They grow disenchanted with the intellect and disenchanted with ideas. It means that for the first time in most of our lives, in a realistic way, not in a hurtful way like, I'm just stupid, I don't know what's going on. In a realistic way, we understand that what I have learned about myself in relation to the world is lacking four key elements. Suffering arises, craving for and clinging to ignorant ideas originates and perpetuates that. It's possible to end this process. And that fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, is the path for ending, putting out the fires of passion. We become disenchanted with our own notions of self in relation to the world, our own ideas. We become completely disenchanted with that. So people that sometimes object at the surface level with this idea of becoming disenchanted, it sounds like we are placing an overly harsh judgment on the world. Why would we want to become disenchanted? Well, we want to become disenchanted with the world because we understand the stress and suffering that is inherent in being attached to the world. It doesn't mean that we no longer live in the world. In fact, free of those types of discursive and discriminating thoughts, I like this, I don't like that, I don't care about any of this, is the way that we keep ourselves distracted from actually being involved in our lives. So contrary to what the initial thought might be when we encounter this, the idea of becoming disenchanted with the world, it seems like annihilation. Excuse me. What in fact the Buddha is teaching us and offering us is the ability to actually experience our life at the most profound level. So those that feel initially, and almost every person I've ever taught has come up against this, those that feel initially that Dhamma practice is going to somehow take portions of life away from them that we want to cling to, I want to hold on to this, I'll get a little bit of peace of mind by letting go of that, but I'm not letting go of this, can understand that it's clinging to those fabricated ideas that is the heart of the problem. It's what must be recognized and abandoned. Continue. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, they grow disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. Through dispassion, they are fully released. Such clear direction to how we gain what we're all here as wise Dhamma practitioners. They grow disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, we become dispassionate. Through dispassion, we are fully released. Through dispassion, we are fully released. With full release, there is the knowledge. It's such an important thing. This one line can be overlooked, and it's key to the Dhamma. With full release, there is the knowledge. Ehepisiko. Full knowledge means we have had a direct experience of something, and we understand it because we have the framework of the Eightfold Path in which to apply right view in this moment. With full release, there is a knowledge, fully released. We know it. They discern that birth is ended, meaning the the any possibility of giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, we know that that is ended. There's nothing left inside of us to provoke another moment rooted in ignorance. Birth has ended. The fully integrated life has been fulfilled. The task is done. There is nothing further for this world. Meaning, and it doesn't mean, again, annihilation. Some people actually teach to this day that when you awaken, poof, you vanish. Of course, that alone just dismisses what happened to the Buddha after he awakened. He didn't vanish, did he? He spent 45 of the most remarkable human years anybody ever spent. And so, just to kind of come back to that point, rather than having nothing further for the world as far as ignorant attachments, what we now become is fully present in the world without any attachments. It's the ultimate freedom, isn't it? It's freedom of the way we think and feel in relation to the world moment by moment in our life as our life unfolds. This is what the Blessed One said. Use the term from the translation. Gratified. The monks were delighted at his words. And while the explanation was being given, the hearts and minds of 1,000 monks, through no clinging, meaning not being sustained, were fully released from their fermentations. The end of today's talk. So I think that's a fitting cap on our Dhamma study. I think almost any Dhamma study, but it's such an important sutta. It's one sutta that we used to always teach, or I used to always teach it on our Saturday night on our retreats. We've changed the schedule a little bit. But because of that, I've seen people, and maybe we can talk a little bit about this when we go around, that heard this sutta and got such tremendous insight into what the Buddha was teaching that things kind of fell into place for them. And it is that powerful sutta for many, many people. So, all right, let's go. We'll go around and see what you have to think. I'm going to start on the bottom. Laura, how are you? Hi, Laura.
Hi, everyone. this sutta is amazing. I feel like I was thinking about all sorts of other suttas as you were talking, you know, kind of, it really pulls everything together into kind of a nutshell. You know, I was just reflecting on how when we come to meditate or we come to class, it's sort of, you know, this little bubble where we really get to see this, what was being described in the sutta at work. You know, that's why we practice. And this idea of like point of contact and not throwing another arrow in, you know, to stop the cycle and yep. to stop, you know, that's kept coming up when I was hearing you talk and, it's beautiful. It's amazing. I mean, I feel like I heard it so differently. I've heard this before, the sutta before, but this morning it was even clearer. And maybe that happens every time I hear a teaching again, but it really, the depth of it and the simplicity, you know, and I think after being able to be in practice for a number of years, it really starts to just click even more. Thank you. And I'm probably going to have to dip out. I have some things to take care of, but I'm glad I got to come to class this morning and hear your teachings. They're invaluable. So I'm so grateful for everyone. Yeah. And for you. Thank
you. Me too. Thank you for joining us, Laura. And will you give Junie a big hug from all of us and maybe a quick happy birthday to you?
Okay.
Thanks. Say hi to Matt and the rest too. Let's go to Dathane. Dathane, how are you this morning?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm here.
Good.
Yes, of course. It's a wonderful sutta.
I wanted to kind of explore with you I think my favorite word is nuance. Nuance, but, understanding. If I'm talking with somebody, like let's say I'm talking with a philosopher or talking with a scientist, or talking with someone who employs critical reason, and you come across the sutta which talks about being disenchanted with the intellect, being disenchanted with ideas, one wonders how they take that. And I would like, you know, for you to kind of explore what is the relationship between being a person that, you know, because I find critical thinking to be very valuable and needed, and yet being disenchanted with the intellect. Like if I were to give you a just a short sentence that would say that critical thinking means making reasoned judgments that are logical and well thought out, how does that relate to the practice of the one of the final legs, being disenchanted with intellect and ideas?
So I don't want this to be a broad condemnation of science, because I don't mean that to be that way. I think science has brought us some great benefit to humanity, and will continue to do so. It's also brought us some terribly horrible things. And so my quick answer, and we could spend hours just talking about this, but my quick answer is that any scientist would be a much better scientist, just like a cab driver would be a better cab driver, if their minds were framed by right view rather than wrong view. You would simply become to even more scientifically realistic conclusions. But there's a danger with that. And there's some very famous modern Buddhist teachers that, one in particular, has made the claim that if science disproves something that the Buddha taught, you should go with science. And that completely contradicts Four Noble Truths, doesn't it? So there's no pat answer to thing that how you might talk with somebody or listen to or even follow science. But as wise Dhamma practitioners, it's always best to listen to things through a mind rooted in right view than a mind that is prone to, like this sutta teaches us, continue to grasp after passions. And then you could say that even this current, I don't want to get into a big discussion about this, but it seems like just for every world famous scientist, every single one has a different point of view on this. So where does that take me as a Dhamma practitioner is to understand that nobody really knows what's occurring in the world right now, but I know what's occurring in the world in general. Stress and suffering arises and there's nothing personal about it. And so I hope that's a helpful response to things.
Do you mind if I cut in for a second, John?
Yes, who's there?
This is Jen.
Hey, Jen.
I'm a scientist, so just wanted to say one thing.
Great.
That the heart of critical thinking, I'm also a teacher, so critical thinking is a phrase that teachers just love to use. And I just really think that at the heart of critical thinking is just true discernment.
It's another way of saying right view.
Right. Yeah. You have to let go of your own personalization of what is occurring to be able to truly see what is occurring. And that is, I want to say that is science, because there's so much attachment and human existence within the scientific community, but if you're following a scientific method, you are just observing what is occurring, and talking about that.
Yeah, and the biggest difficulty in scientific inquiry is, and this has been known for a while, is how do you keep the scientist's own bias, no matter what it is, out of their conclusions? And that's almost impossible. And that doesn't mean that science is useless because of it. It simply means we should also have our own most critical thinking that is resting in right view. That's the, and you know, I mean, I could.
Well, you know, I've seen it read that, you know, the difference between weak critical thinking and strong critical thinking is weak critical thinking will investigate others' issues, attachments. I even seen the word attachments. Biases, but they don't see themselves. they take down the other person's argument, but they don't put themselves in the other person's shoes and then argue from both standpoints. So to be attached to your own view. So for me, it seems like the Buddha is talking about, you know, not clinging to your own biases, which would move one automatically to strong critical thinking when you begin to employ other practices.
Yeah, that's what I said. I think anybody, including a scientist, would be better at what they do if they would develop right view. But you know, I mean, that's just the truth. I mean, that's the nature of the Buddha's teachings, is ultimately that we become human beings. I was going to say better human beings, but it's not really, because unless you know what a human being is, you can't be one, can you? You have to know. You can live a life rooted in greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking, or you can wake up. And so the science and scientific inquiry and scientific establishments are just that. They're simply part of the world. They're an important part of the world, but they're not something that any wise human being would worship, because that's just what that is. That's rooted in ignorance. Again, it doesn't, because I don't understand completely how a car operates, is no reason why I shouldn't take a ride once in a while. And it's, so the point is, what's most important to me isn't whether science is right or wrong, or how it's right and how it's wrong. What's important to me is the quality of my mind in this present moment. And in that way, I'm not concerned about scientific opinions that I might not agree with. I just live in the world. And so it's just another, science is another aspect, like government and bags of Fritos. It's just part of the world. It has its place. It has levels of importance, but it's just part of the world. So thank you for bringing it up, Thane. It's really an important point. Right next to you on my screen is Lorna. How are you, Lorna? Hey, Lorna.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm sorry. I'm very good, thank you. I love the comment that Thane mentioned when you were talking, when he said that you could use the word enslaved.
Yeah.
Well, yes, enslaved is a very sensitive word socially these days, obviously, without question. But how appropriate it is to how we enslave ourselves to our thoughts and following on in conditioned thinking. And I mean, it's such a totally great word to use. And I do thank him for asking that question or just mentioning that. Listening to the whole sutta in total, I could just say, I wish I could see all that he sees and understand all that he understands. And how can I say? It's just such a totally wonderful description of what he woke, what he learnt, and it's a wonderful description. It starts with describing the problem, but also you can see the solution to the problem. And in this sutra as well. And it's just, you just think, you know, I wish I could develop that thinking. It's so wonderful. It's a great sutra.
It is, and I would say you are developing that thinking. You know, it's what we're doing. So thank you, Lauren. I'm glad you joined us this morning. Michael, how are you?
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good.
I just wrote a couple of notes down.
Oh, that's Mary.
Nothing too important. But this, you know, again, like, where, you know, everything's, a flame, so to say, or inflamed until we become disenchanted. And from there, this all leads to understanding who we are, what we are in this phenomenal world. Again, impermanence comes in. Everything comes back to the understanding of impermanence and the relationship between anatta and anicca, you know, for me anyhow.
Yep.
what else is I going to say? And again, once this becomes realized or we understand it fully, that's when we develop right view. And once we're seeing things through that like profound right view, then we're kind of like we're releasing ourselves, you know. And that's the only point that I wanted to make there.
That's a pretty important point, Michael. Thank you. How are you, Julia?
Hi, John.
Good to see you.
I wrote a little summary of it. Through point of contact, the individual worships what contacts the senses, and this is how the individual perpetuates the ego self. Through right view, we can realize clinging and craving and stop or release the process of fermentation, birth, and death. Understanding the true nature of reality allows us to have dispassion and become disenchanted with the identification of the self in sensory fulfillment. Through dispassion grows discernment and wisdom. So that's what I wrote as my summary for this discourse. I really enjoyed the sutta. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, John.
Yeah. Thank you, Julia. What an important line there. Understanding brings dispassion. That's it. That's the essence of the Dhamma right there. So, thank you. Mary, how are you? Good morning, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
Good to hear you. There you are.
There I am. Hi. This is a very important sutta. I've been impacted by this sutta in many different ways early on in my practice. Was the first time I ever became aware that my fabrications were right view. I thought they were. They were.
Yep.
Principles. And that was a big wow, and those were released, you know, in that moment. And so this is really important. You know, I still suffer fabrications and fermentations. I think, as I often say, there's more work to be done. But as Lorna, you know, reiterated, you become enslaved to these things.
Yep.
That you're holding on to. And that's harder than letting them go and living a life of ease and joy. So we create our own resistance and degree of difficulty by holding on to these things. So, the world is a flame, and there's more work to be done. So, thank you, John. Thanks.
Thank you, Mary. As you're talking, and I'm sure I'll feel this way about all of you. It's just remarkable the level of understanding that you have, and how we're not talking in any conceptual applications, or we're describing how we're practicing the Dhamma. This is what the Buddha meant by ehipasiko. Come and see for yourself. So thank you. I got Lorna. Kevin Roach, how are you?
Very good, John. Everybody can hear me, I hope.
Yes.
I was just going to follow up on this idea of science. You know, science is really very important. You know, it's yeah. my livelihood is based on science also. I couldn't do it unless I believed in science.
Yeah.
But science isn't the explanation for everything. Scientific ideas are impermanent. They're constantly evolving. The science we have today is not the science that the Buddha had.
Yep.
But the Dhamma does provide the explanation. It does provide the foundation for everything. Yeah. And I find that this sutta really encapsulates the entire Dhamma. It is complete. And it moves us toward compassion.
Thank you, Kevin. You're so right. Human beings rooted in ignorance have this difficult thing to deal with, and it has to do with that wrong view. And so that type of mind is really incapable of seeing something in a broad term that could say there's such a thing as good science and bad science. In other words, a mind has to say one thing is either has to be one way or another. There's nothing in between. And this is the problem with, well, I'm going to get a little bit off topic. This is a problem with that new agey, but been around 2,600 years idea that we're all of one mind. And so when you start this talking about discriminating between things, just seeing the reality of life, the Buddha taught not to see everything as one big mass, one single ball of ignorance. He taught to see everything that arises and passes away in its absolute discreteness, not in its unity. And so in that way, we can see things like good science and bad science and mediocre science. And the same thing with everything else, good manufacturing processes, poor, it's all part of the same thing. And it's being able to see things in reality rather than have to classify things as, and look what's playing out in our politics. You're either on the right or the left now. You know, there's no real middle view. And look, it's tearing the country apart, those extreme views. I want to get into that. But that's the point. The Buddha taught to simply see things as they are. And so if there's a reasonable, again, getting not to get too deep into the science, but if there's a scientific practice and theory that we found useful, we should continue it. But we shouldn't be so stuck on something because it has a scientific label that we don't look at maybe some of its inefficiencies. And that's where the problem comes. You know, it's the Thane brought up such an important point, because as a society, we may want to give too much credence to one thing over another rather than actually see what is in accordance with right view and what isn't. And that's what we're talking about. It's remarkable. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Sarah, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. One of the things that I really love about the Buddha's teaching is that it's not philosophical and it's not religious dogma. The things that he teaches, to each degree that you take them or you realize it, you become aware of something or you recognize it and you implement it, or you recognize it because you experimented and you found this out, that it's real, it's true. It really does cause suffering to be caught up in our senses, and that for me has been a tremendous source of suffering.
Yeah.
And not only just the feelings, but the thoughts, the being, coming to that place where you kind of are disenchanted with your intellect, even. I've come to that place because it's gotten me in so much trouble.
Yeah, all of us.
You know, yeah, and every once in a while, I put these things into practice and I find the freedom of it, I can find this like beautiful peace, and then this little nagging thing will be, oh, but it's horrible the way that they treated you. It's terrible that you know you've been this has been unjust, and for this moment I think, yeah, and why should I become a doormat, or why should I, you know, if I always do the right thing and I always view life dispassionately, then the whole world is just going to take advantage of me and treat me poorly. I'll be happy, but they're going to treat me poorly and poor me. and then in that moment, it's like, yes, and is this the kind of suffering that you want to endure? One of the things that is interesting about COVID-19 to me is that, and the situation that I'm in, is that it kind of forces me into this place of, I have to stay where I am. This is not me, you know very well. I've been in a complete state of upheaval for the last 2 years, over and over and over again, my life constantly overturning, which is normal, you know, everything comes and goes, but it's forced me to have to stay in what situation that I'm in and solve the suffering problem by coming to this place of peace. Yep. Instead of trying to change the situation all the time. So mm-hmm. Namaste.
And you're gaining some great benefits, Sarah, right?
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And you are, because you've learned to apply the Dhamma as it's intended, just like we talked to you at the point of contact. You could say at the point of our difficulties. That's where we bring it, instead of running away from them. So I'm glad you joined us this morning.
And also the refuge of the Sangha, that when you hear that in other people too, it just rebuilds that up in you, and the and and that courage erupts. So thank you to all.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. And we're going to get into that even a little bit deeper over our retreat, but you know what it means to take true refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and this wonderful Sangha that we have here. So glad you joined us. Tim, how are you?
Morning, everybody. So this discourse basically to what Michael was saying, all suffering, delusion, despair, dukkha is a result of anatta, desiring that what is impermanent be permanent, anicca, period. And then the solution or the way of that is with disenchantment comes dispassion, dispassion, release, and then wisdom. And the Fire Discourse ties up everything we've been talking about these last 12 weeks.
Yep, everything.
Disenchantment and dispassion. And there's no reason to even try to, you know, talk about, you know, scientists and enslaved and all that. It is what it is. He says it quite clearly. And I think all the other things just kind of muddy it up a bit.
Well, the Buddha does use those phrases. I mean, he uses the word a flame, you know.
That's what I mean. Yeah. The one thing I wanted to ask you, though, John, and I've had questions about this for quite some time.
Yeah.
And that is the point of contact through the sixth sense space. And Buddha, Buddha explained it in this first paragraph of this discourse, and so did you with the eye consciousness. But wouldn't the point of contact through the sixth sense space result in the perception interpretation that results, then has that result of feeling from that? I mean, in other words, what we hear, what we see, what we feel, we perceive them. And I wanted you to kind of just touch base on that a little bit. I know what Buddha was getting at there. I do. But for me, maybe it's the science that Jen was talking about. And when I think about it, what I see, what I hear, what I feel, what I smell is all it's perception. And it's actually, I mean, you could put somebody somewhere and teach them that red is blue. I guess that's what I'm saying. But that always kind of gets me a little confused. With the point of contact through the consciousness of the sixth sense space?
Yes, it's an important question because I guess this the subtle level of Dhamma practice, depending on what and this, boy, it relates to everything. It relates to karma and rebirth. What I'm holding in mind will determine my experience of what is occurring right here and right now. Next moment, what I'm holding in mind is going to determine my experience of what's occurring right here and right now, on and on and on. So it is through the thinking process that a human being relates to what's occurring, isn't it? So if that thinking process is not rooted in reality, meaning rooted in an understanding of what's occurring, its perceptions won't follow reality. They'll follow the presently helded wrong view, which is, and a way to describe that is mindfulness. So not all mindfulness is great. What we hold in mind determines our experience. And the Buddha taught an eightfold path to take a mind that is rooted in ignorance, grasping, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking, and take that very same mind through this simple and direct process and transform it into a mind that can trust itself to interpret reality. And so, again, as a human being, we're just designed that way. We come in contact with reality through our senses. And if that sixth sense of our thinking is not rooted in reality, we cannot possibly hope to perceive things based on reality. Does that help, Tim?
Yeah, no, it does. And that's what I presumed. I just wanted to make sure that I was looking at it with discernment.
And Tim, what's remarkable to me, and I'm not just saying this because it's your birthday, and it's not, what's remarkable is that, and I think everyone else here understands it, is that that is such a subtle level of understanding to be able to see that. That's Dhamma practice. So you really developed the Dhamma to a very remarkable and effective way. So and thank you for bringing that up.
John, could I throw in something here?
Yes, please.
In cognitive science, there is a lot of explanation of the process already. When we see something, when the first, you know, when light hits our eye and then travels along the optic nerve and gets into the parts of the brain that are running that, the information gets changed on the way, and it goes from just, you know, objective little pixels to already we're seeing edges, we're seeing patterns, and then the our feeling part comes in at the same time. Now it goes from being objective things to being something familiar, something unfamiliar, and then we start the liking part that comes in there. So all these things are already baked into our brain functions. So when we start applying the Dhamma, we're in a way rewiring some of our brain.
Well, we're rewiring all of our brain. I can't remember who it was. One of our Sangha members used to talk about that, how external events can change our brains. But that's what our brains are able to do that. Based on how we think, certainly, and that's the whole nature of stress, isn't it? That it, as far as it relates to good or bad health, stress is something that primarily first occurs in the mind, doesn't it? And then it is experienced throughout the body. Of course it will. It has to. We're human beings with a mind hopefully united in its body. So it will naturally occur that way. A good example of how a eye consciousness can lead to stress or lead to peace is it's simple the way we look at each other. So a human being who is prejudiced against black people, like you can be prejudiced against anybody. Let's use the example because it's such an obvious one. It's such a ridiculous one that we judge. I mean, from when I was a little kid, I grew up in a world that was still deeply prejudiced and still in deeply judged people by the way they look. And I always thought it was crazy. How do I know someone is an awful person or going to hurt me because of the color of their skin? Or it's just crazy. But because we've taught ourselves to believe that when a human being sees another human being of a skin color that they don't approve, they react to it, sometimes violently. But it's all a fabrication, isn't it? And not to just use that, we are trained in the world to see a human being, and evaluate that human being based on how they look. And as a man growing up in the world that I grew up in, I was taught that I should see the opposite sex in only one way, and anything beyond that was unacceptable. I thought it was crazy. I can remember being 12 years old thinking, what is this? How can this be? How can we create a society that agrees that only a small fraction of people on the planet are acceptable to everyone? And everybody else, it just does not make any sense. And I don't want to get into this, the arising of prejudice and where it comes from, and the modern word now, xenophobic. But that's such a perfect example of it, isn't it? When I see anything, something hits my eye, and I decide based on fabricated thinking that what is hitting my eye needs to be different than it is, whether it's a human being or a red Ferrari that I need to be green to be acceptable to me. It's all just causing stress and distraction from what's actually occurring, isn't it? And that's the subtle aspect that the Buddha is teaching here. It's at these very subtle aspects that a lot of us are talking about. Tim really, really hit it there. That's where we lose our minds, when we're not able to do that. When we give in to very subtle aspects of passion. This was even more common during the Buddha's time. We can't forget that the Buddha grew up. Well, he grew up and he lived within a very tightly controlled society. India was even more divided by class then than it is now, even though it still is. It's come a long way. But it was a very strict way of living in the world. So much so that unless you were of a certain class, you weren't even allowed to go listen to the Buddha or you would probably be killed. Of course, the Buddha didn't put up with that. He taught a completely equalitarian Dhamma. Anybody could come and listen to it because he didn't have that wrong view in his eye. He didn't see it. So when somebody who might be considered one of the, what's the word that they use? Unmentionable or something? The lowest class of people, when they would walk into the Sangha, the Buddha simply didn't notice him. That's all. It wasn't even an issue.
Yeah, like untouchables.
Untouchables, yeah. There was no such thing as an untouchable in the Buddha's mind, so there was no such thing as an untouchable in his society that he lived in. Of course, everywhere else it was. But he was able to maintain a calm and peaceful mind despite all the racism and misogyny and xenophobic behavior that was common during his time. It didn't matter to him. And the same is true for us. There's issues in the world that still need to be resolved, but I don't have to lose my mind over it anymore, do I? I've lost track a little bit. Kevin, how are you?
Great, John. Really appreciate the talk. I think you mentioned it earlier. This is a very impactful sutta, I think, for everybody as they begin and continue their Dhamma practice. This is a point of reference. I think it's a point of breaking through, of understanding. I think a lot of others are sharing that. I felt that as well. I think on the first retreat, when we did sort of dependent origination and intensive, and then this followed that. And, you know, this is, I don't want to think, you know, it's not like they're all important or, you know, they're not all important, but this is, you know, I'll always remember that moment Juan Dharma Center, sitting in the big hall, hearing this after, three days of being on retreat. It is something that I would say opened some understanding, maybe into profound right view. And I think that's what's being expressed here by the Sangha, especially Tim and so on. I think I like the point he made about trusting perceptions and so on. And that's an intricate way to see ignorance and fabrications, how they develop, and insight into dependent origination there. You know, when we see something that's walking out in the backyard with four legs and it's furry, our mind can easily say, well, that's a cat. And we can go into, as Ram just said, the process of how information is attached into our thoughts. And instead of the subtle difference of, well, that looks and walks and is something like a cat. It looks like a cat. You know, there's a difference in attachment and a difference in, you know, it seems so subtle. It doesn't really make sense probably to people that wouldn't be tuning into this talk, but I think all of everybody else can understand that subtlety of how once we see something, you know, I think, therefore I am. It's that, yep. Once we attach it, we say, well, there, it's a cat. We've already gone down the trap door then, because now it's a pretty rigid view, as we've seen. So thanks for everybody's contributions today.
Thank you, Kevin. Becky, how are you this morning?
Just unmute.
Becky! Hey, I unmuted you. No, I didn't.
There.
There you are.
Now?
Yep.
Okay. This sutta is pretty comprehensive, and it is amazing to continue to hear it and to hear it again, because it just brings back to the front of your mind what you are trying to do, what you are working toward. And it's easy for me to lose that thread in my daily life, and this brings it right back to the front of your mind.
Yeah.
And the thing that I wrote down is the Dhamma must be applied in the present moment at the point of contact. And I think that is what at least I need to remember. That is what I need to know, to take what I, my concentration from my cushion into my life. And it's just an incredible sutta. It's just incredible. And what everyone has said has been, has added so much understanding for me. Mm-hmm. So thank you all. Thank you, John, and namaste.
Thank you, Becky. Let's go to Jen. Good morning, Jen.
Hey, Jen. Okay. Hi, everybody. I love this sutta. And I get so excited when I hear it. And then to hear everybody else's comments, I'm so excited right now. I could like just, you know, run around the room because everything everybody was saying was like, yeah, yeah, I was thinking that too. Yeah, yeah, too. And I just like, so I'm trying to just, you know, I just can't wait to hug and high five you guys when I get to see you again. But yeah, I mean, really what I was thinking about early on when you were when we were listening to this again was basically what everybody else is touching on. And I was thinking about it in terms of, you know, my understanding and my conditioning, and which is really knowledge about the anatomy and the physiology of the brain and how there's different parts of the brain that actually process visual or auditory or, you know, olfactory information. Just the visual process, for example, Ram was touching on this, is there's the visual cortex, which receives visual data. And then there's the processing center, visual processing center, that actually integrates and processes and, you know, perceives or whatever word you want to use that information. So as soon as we become aware of visual data, that's, it doesn't matter where it is along the chain of dependent origination, but wherever it is that we become aware of it, that's where we practice the Dhamma.
Yeah.
Where we say, okay, this is my karma, this is my opportunity to yep, either be framed or lost. Wow. And but you guys all, you know, I just wanted to, I guess I just kind of swept up. Oh, I think I just did a Kevin Hart. I feel like Kevin Hart's always doing the sweeping up, just bringing it right back.
Yeah, you did a Kevin Hart, but you did it beautifully. I mean, that's again, but we're all talking about the essence of the Dhamma. We understand finally, just kidding, that the Dhamma is practiced right here and right now. It's the essence of mindfulness, of right mindfulness. So thank you, Jen. Anthony, how are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm doing well, and I hope everybody else is too. I've always loved hearing the Fire Discourse talk, and I'm going to exercise noble silence. But before I do that, I just hope that everybody is doubling down on the Eightfold Path, keeping up their meditation, and using this time, this challenging time, to go deeper. Because that's what, you know, that's how we can all benefit.
Great advice. Tell Debbie I said hello. She's doing well?
Thank you. Yes, we're both doing well.
Good, 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 good. How are you, Ram?
Thank you for asking.
Yeah, it's amazing that this is like the second discourse, and he just, you know, blows this huge audience away. With what he comes up with, and it's completely radical and just, there's nothing out there. There wasn't anything out there like that, and there still isn't. And we're still getting blown away by this. And the first time I heard this, what struck me then was this, you know, because I lived in the old hippie world, and we were all going to do, we'll live by our passions.
Yep.
And God, did I hate
that. Was that. Freedom. That was freedom.
Yeah, that was freedom. Yeah. And it never worked for me. And when I heard this, it was like, oh, that's just completely off base. You know, disenchantment is actually an important part of life. And this passion is an important part of my yeah. path. That there was so much freedom in that. So it's good to hear it again. And, you know, may all our little minds get blown again.
Yeah. thank you, Ron. It was so well said. I never saw the Buddha as rock star, but I guess he is. You know, this is a remarkable sutta. It's always inspiring to me just to teach it. I love teaching it because it's so powerful. And again, it's a complete Dhamma teaching. But so what we've done in the last few months is another complete Dhamma teaching. It seems like every year we go through this course, it's just deeper and deeper for every one of you. It's just remarkable. So well done for all of you. Again, we'll finish up our Tuesday class, which some of you come to both classes with the same sutta.
Are we coming to a conclusion? I had a last comment.
Please.
Just to jump on, his name is Ram, right? R-O-M or R-A-M?
R-A-M.
R-A-M, yeah. He really, I feel like his comment really hit the nail on the head, because when I look at this term, when I look at understanding brings dispassion, the word that zeroes in for me is understanding. And how, you know, because reading the Buddhist teachings, there's a point of being revolted by what this whole cycle, that you have to go through that journey. It's not just like just intellectual understanding. Oh, this is what the sutta says, so I'm going to follow it. No, there's a journey of eating suffering again, being mindful of the whole process, eating suffering again, being mindful of the whole process until you become revolted. Like, you know what? Enough is enough. I'm done with the game. And So for me, mindfulness becomes such a central piece of why we are just using mindfulness to go through the deep and co-origination cycle so that we can finally, from the emotional understanding, from a deep, place, visceral place, to say, I'm going to make another choice. For me, this is something that comes up for me. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Dathain. And that points to, again, right to the Eightfold Path. And the sixth factor of the Eightfold, the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. It's not just being mindful, and I would say compulsively mindful, meaning, well, I've learned to be mindful, so I hold in mind anything that comes into mind, which is what the Buddha's taught. Anything that I'm passionate about, I should be mindful. So it just encourages that continued, what I call, mindless mindfulness. The Buddha teaches us through the Eightfold Path. This is why it can't be substituted. We need the Eightfold Path to provide that framework to develop right mindfulness, to know what to hold in mind and what not to. And when we do that, then the Dhamma becomes as effective as we've all talked about here. And as the Buddha teaches, we understand our own passions. We don't try to excuse them away. We don't try to embellish them in any way by giving them some kind of power. You know, it's my passion is my, and I'm not putting down an individual when I say this. I'm not going to follow my passion. To me, it's the same as saying I'm going to follow my bliss. Well, my bliss led me down a couple of bottles of vodka every day and a couple of bags of dope every day. That was my passion. And some people, their passion is 14 pizzas a day. Some people's passions are too much work, too much. The level of distraction or the distractionary events that we create are endless. Or we can simply develop jhana meditation and create this wonderful framework for looking at our life moment by moment called the Eightfold Path and maintain a calm and peaceful and a calm and peaceful mind resting in the inner poise from understanding. So it's just a great sutta. It's been a great truth of happiness study. So any other questions or comments on this study and on today's class? Okay, one thing briefly. The three teachers that are with us, I'd like to talk to you about something just briefly. I don't mean to ignore the rest of you, but then we'll get to something else. Are the three of you done with your editing of the next book?
I still need to go over what we talked about before and do a quick run through, make sure that the edits actually
okay.
took.
Jen?
I'm sorry, John. No, I have to. That was on my agenda for tomorrow.
Okay. And so I won't. Kevin?
Gone too.
So what I'll ask you to do then is just let me know when you're finished, so I'll stop asking you.
John,
and then I'm going to ask you to go. The way this thing is working with Google Docs, I've never used it to go through this proofing process. Then I'm going to go back and go through it once more, and then I'm going to ask you to just look at it once more after I've done that, so you can make sure that I've made the corrections that you've suggested. Just to scan your section again quickly. So just let me know when you're done, and then we'll get this thing, get it published. You know, the Dhammapada is ready too, by the way. So when you're ready, I'll keep you working. This is is the new Cross River Meditation Publishing Incorporated. So,
John.
Yes.
I did finish, and I left you the comments. I don't know if you saw them. So.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'll look at them later. I got to get used to the process. So the other thing I think I did talk about, the retreat, the schedule is on the website. If you're going to join us, please send me an email whether you're reserved for the spring retreat or not. If you are reserved for the spring retreat, your reservation is now for the fall retreat. When you come into the room, even during the schedule, try to join us at least a few minutes early. I will open the room at least 15 minutes. I'm talking about the retreat now, just like we do here. I'll open those rooms at least 15 minutes before the scheduled start time so we can come together as a Sangha and do that. I think that's it as far as that's concerned. I probably didn't need to make those announcements in the recorded portion of this, but I did, so there it is. And we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.